at trial. And by trial, they never find Archie. So this is a co-defendant being charged under the law of parties in a complicated charge about whether it's aggravated rape or regular rape. And there's a discussion as to whether, because he testifies, I was only there because Archie was the one pointing the gun at me. So I might be guilty of anything, but I was under duress. And so the charge itself is hard. Junior is 21 years old at the time. So he's young. There's all sorts of testimony about what he did and didn't do. And what's even more complicated is the jury acquits him on one of the counts of aggravated rape, but convicts him on other. And it's really hard to determine what's the basis of his liability. And there's testimony that Junior severs the phone line and that they act as friends. And so there's enough evidence to be able to find him guilty as a party. But the charge becomes a recipe for disaster. And this is where the basis of all of our case law on Amansa starts. So there's a confusion about the law of parties. There's a confusion about the aggravating factors. And then there's a disjunctive versus conjunctive charge combined with the law of parties that just becomes a mess. The case goes back and forth. It gets remanded, and his 30-year prison sentence is upheld. Cases are about people. And so I wanted to find out, you know, is he out or what happened? And sadly, his name is so distinctive that there is another Almanza. There is Cipriano Roman Alfonso Alonso III. And unfortunately, he is in prison right now for murder. So he was born just a few years after this conviction. So it's unclear again how that occurred. But when you look at the body of case law that comes after Almanza, you have this idea that if there's an objection, all you need to be able to do is show some harm. And if there's no objection, then at that point we use the egregious harm standard. So whether it's 442A or 442B, when we're looking at other errors, we just keep going back and back and back. And I think one of the neatest quotes is that deciding how this basic test is applied is really as important as just determining what that test is. And the way that happened was, in Almanza, the court says this wonderful language: we cannot improve from what we have done since 1890. And since 1890, determining whether error is, whether we call it fundamental or egregious, was the nature of the testimony enough to sustain the verdict? Was the evidence overwhelming? Was the theory cogent? Was the character of the testimony at some point related to the omission in the charge? What was the theory? In other words, what was the jury wrestling with? And you see appellate judges kind of struggle with having to make facts on the basis of nuance and trying to embody what was the jury thinking by finding an acquittal on one count. And this is where it leads us to this idea that we need to have actual, not theoretical harm. And as you look to that, you know, Malik, and as a Spurs fan, it's always Malik to me because of Malik Rose. But if Malik talks about this idea of what a hypothetically correct jury charge does when we look at a sufficiency of evidence case, right? Malik is a crazy case involving an exclusionary rule instruction on a possession of a firearm case and an argument that the person never should have been stopped. And it pings back and forth from the Court of Appeals to the CCA when presiding Judge Keller just says, look, it's just too complicated. And I think that the instructions are great because it says if you look at the charging instrument, it allows one issue. If you look at the jury charge, you can look at another. So for sufficiency, Malik gets kind of embedded in all of this mess when we look at charge analysis. And I include it only to be able to say what I think is fascinating is we have this concept of a hypothetically correct jury charge. Well, if you put 12 people together, is there a hypothetically correct jury? And if so, you know, in trial, we get to see our veneer panel. We get to be able to make objections, strikes. We get to ask questions, follow-ups. There's an intimate process. And we see them as they process evidence. And again, we try to make assumptions on whether we're winning or losing based upon eye contact or body language or how they feel about witnesses. But on appeal, we don't know them. And so I want to imagine kind of what a hypothetically correct jury would look like. and what it should look like. Is a hypothetically correct jury one that is more concerned about details or about the big picture? Is a hypothetically correct jury, do they care more about scientific proof or common sense? What about logic versus emotional intelligence? Should they be passionate about the issue or should they be detached when they deliberate? How do you measure harm without some idea of how people look at this charge and use it?